Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, UKIP are celebrating significant gains in the local council elections in England. They've won more than 165 seats. UKIP leader Nigel Farage has been out meeting supporters, insisting his party is here to stay.
The political class have been comforting themselves. It's just a protest vote. It'll go away. It looks like a fairly permanent protest.
Meanwhile, David Cameron's hoping to win back support through the recovering economy ahead of next year's general election. The PM says there's little chance of a coalition between the Conservatives and UKIP.
We're the Conservative Party. We don't do pacts and deals. We're fighting all out for an all-out win at the next election. We held councils like Swindon and Tamworth, which were Labour for many, many years before. So I'm confident that in spite of the difficulties, this is a base from which we can go forward and win.
Labour did make gains, but didn't do as well as hoped, doing little to suggest they're certain of an overall majority in a Westminster poll. With some areas still counting, the Lib Dems are down around 200 seats. In other news, former broadcaster Stuart Hall has been sentenced to an extra 2.5 years in jail for indecently assaulting an underage girl. The 84-year-old's already serving a 30-month term for assaulting 13 others over a 20-year period. Energy firms involved in the controversial practice of fracking could be allowed to drill under people's homes without permission. The government's put the idea out for consultation, along with a proposal to increase compensation to £20,000 per well. But these people in Balcombe in West Sussex, where fracking is expected, aren't happy.
Why would they think of putting up the what they call compensation? If you've got compensation, surely somebody's been injured or damaged.
Well, it indicates recompense.
Yeah.
Bribe.
Yeah.
I'm very sad that, you know, we haven't been listened to and that money seems to be more important than the environment as usual.
And Facebook says it's listened to its customers. Anyone signing up for the first time will automatically have posts restricted to friends and family. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gove.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
BCFM. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping him in review. This week's news is Conservative MP for North East Somerset, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, global power blocks shifting like tectonic plates as China and Russia signed big energy deals this week. If Ukraine is all about gas, where does that leave the West? And the NATO's secret political lobby, the shadowy Bilderberg Group, that includes all the big energy firms, banks, royalty and arms firms, they're meeting in Copenhagen next week. This show will have live reports from Denmark next Friday, but just how have the Bilderbergs managed to avoid scrutiny by the mainstream press for 60 years? Also, part three of Paul Mason's series that he thinks could not be made in Britain today, that's a TV series, we do it instead. It's the First World War, the People's First World War, part three, The Revolutions. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 and some showers. This weekend, highs of 16 degrees Celsius. Showers on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday, and also on bank holiday Monday. Lovely. Just about 3 days of holiday now. And it's going to be sunny too, we hope, Sunday and Monday. Next week, highs of 17 Celsius, sunshine and showers next week. Next weekend, that's the 31st of May and the 1st of June, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Conservative MP for North East Somerset. Joining us on the phone, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Hi, Jacob, and welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, Jacob, we heard in the news there about fracking Could you just give us your views on this? Because the BBC has just announced from the government, this is, we're going to be boosting fracking with new access to land rules. The UK government's proposed new rules regarding rights to access land in a bid to speed up the introduction of fracking. It proposes shale oil and gas companies are granted access to land below 300 metres from the surface. It also suggests firms pay £20,000 per well to those living above the land. The consultation comes as a new report by the British Geological Survey estimates there are 4.4 billion barrels of oil in shale rocks in southern England. Now, the reason for these new rules, Jacob, as I'm sure you know, is that up until now there's been possible for people who live above these to basically to stop them, and that isn't going to be the case in the future. They're going to get some compensation, but I'm afraid if they don't want fracking underneath their homes, it's going to be tough, isn't it?
I'm always very suspicious of governments confiscating property rights. And the ownership of land historically was to the sky and to the centre of the earth. And if that is taken away from people, they deserve compensation for it, that it's not right for the government to undermine property ownership.
Well, they're not actually undermining the ownership. What they're saying is that rather than being able to block fracking, people will simply get some compensation from a fracking firm, but they won't actually be able to stop it. I mean, that's quite a bit of difference between those, isn't it?
It depends on what exact form the legislation takes. I think there is something for the country in fracking, that it seems we are sitting on very large supplies of shale gas, and that these will give us both cheap energy and security of supply. So although we don't receive a great deal from Russia, the rest of the European Union does, and that if the UK could be independent in its gas supply, that would be very positive for us. However, there are a number of questions relating to fracking, one of which is the issue of property rights, and the other is, of course, the size and scale of the plants needed to extract the gas, some of which will be in areas of outstanding natural beauty and so forth.
Now, you're quite a big supporter of fracking, and also it's possible that it will be taking place in the Mendips, Keynsham, these kinds of places. This isn't necessarily going to be popular with your constituents, is it?
I'm very conscious of that. I think that the supply of gas from fracking is potentially extremely exciting. That in the US it saw prices per cubic foot of gas go down from about 10 cents to about 2.5 cents. So there's potentially the chance of a very significant reduction in energy costs. Now, inevitably, it won't be exactly the same as the US in the UK, and the scale may not be as great as that. But still, if there are these quantities of gas, both the security of supply and the cheapness arguments are, I think, very positive. The big negative, and I'm very concerned about this, obviously, in my own constituency, is that the United States has vast areas of land that can be developed without affecting the overall beauty of the country. We don't in the UK. We're a much smaller country. And therefore, the plant that is needed on the surface to extract the shale gas is going to be the centre of the argument. And the scale of it is going to be, in my view, determinative of whether it is suitable in certain parts of the country.
Well, there will also be people who say that actually water contamination will be also a central part of the reasons why people don't like fracking. I mean, in the United States, earlier this year, we heard from the Associated Press that there were 400 complaints just in one state, in Pennsylvania, over contamination of water supplies. This is people's private water wells and also public supplies. So, what happens when, because of the fracking, you can't drink the water?
The issue on water contamination is not one from the fracking itself, that the fracturing of the rock takes place at too deep a level. It's below the water table. The risk of water contamination is if the water that is used when it gets back to the surface is allowed to leak. And that is essentially the same type of risk as if a farmer allows slurry to run off into a stream. It is something that is serious and does contaminate water, but can be well controlled by effective regulation and policing. It's true of all industrial processes that use water. that if the water, once it's been used in an industrial process, is not disposed of safely, there is a risk of contamination to other water supplies. I think some people get confused and think that the risk is that the gas will leak into the water supply. But that won't happen because it's simply too deep. It's too far below the water table.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed on that one, Jacob.
It's not a question of fingers crossed. I mean, this is set out very clearly in a report produced in, I think, 2012 by the Royal Society.
What about the earthquakes, then?
The earthquakes is covered in exactly the same report, and it's well worth reading. The earthquakes have been on the scale, in the Richter scale, of around 2. And a Richter scale of 2, as the report sets out, is something that you don't notice. At 3, it is of the scale of a bus going past outside your front door. It's no more, indeed it's less, than you get from a rock fall in a disused coal mine.
Well, we could say that, but I mean, you know, what happens when there is even low-level earthquakes, Jacob, as you know, is that cracks can appear in people's homes. Now, this, you know, can mean to a tremendous amount of worry. People may even have to move out of their homes as a result. It doesn't necessarily mean that the house is going to shake from side to side, but it does mean damage to houses, doesn't it?
Not at this level. No, at this level it wouldn't damage houses. As I say, it's the same as it's lower than a fall in a disused mine.
This
area, we have many disused mines.
What are the economics behind this? Because that seems to be what's driving this, doesn't it? It's going to be cheaper gas, it's going to somehow boost the economy. Why do we need fracking?
Well, many people live in fuel poverty, and fracking potentially reduces their fuel bills. I think that's hugely exciting for my constituents, that they will be able to heat their homes more comfortably in the winter. And this applies both to supplies of gas, but also, of course, to electricity, a good quantity of which is produced from natural gas.
I mean, if the energy industry in Britain was nationalised, surely that would also halve the price of our energy costs, because so much of what we're paying goes towards shareholders and towards an industry, whereas if it's a nationalised affair, then basically the energy is supplied as it used to be in Britain at cost.
That's not true. The government already takes more money itself from energy supplies than is taken in profits by the energy companies. Their margin is in the region of 5-7%. The government takes 5% VAT plus 20% corporation tax. That's simply inaccurate math.
Okay. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we talk about the election results today, because Jacob, and also because it's in the news today, these new rules to make it easier for companies to do fracking underneath people's homes without them being able to stop them. What are your thoughts about the economics of why the impetus for fracking? To take Jacob's point, what's happened is it's been very successful in the US. It's helped the US to get out of a recovery. Why not here?
Well, it hasn't helped the US to get out of a recovery. Supposedly helped the US to get into a recovery, Tony. I think that fracking...
Sorry, help the US recovery.
Yes, help the US recovery, I think is what you meant. Stuff I've been reading by William Engdahl, who I generally rate, suggests to me that there's a bubble underlying fracking, and I don't mean a physical bubble, I mean a financial bubble. Those who are in favour of fracking are pushing it as a solution to various problems.
Just explain what you mean by a bubble.
Well, I mean, in other words, you say to people, this is the industry of the future, invest in us and you'll make a profit. And if enough people believe that, then the bubble starts to inflate. And it's not just true of fracking, it could be true of anything. I must admit that the details of this I haven't looked into, but I tend to rate what Engdahl says. And I can see that bubbles are very much a part of the way in which the Western capitalist economy works these days. If you sell something big enough, people will jump on the bandwagon and it starts to inflate. You know, a housing bubble, everybody's aware of that. But it can happen in any industry. And it may well be that fracking in the end will turn out to be a busted flush.
Jacob, the housing bubble, would you agree that that's taking place? It certainly looks as if, because everyone needs housing, that this is a perfect thing to inflate the price. I mean, we've seen, haven't we, over the last couple of weeks, prices of homes in London actually increasing by something like £5,000-£10,000 just in 1 month. Unbelievable inflation. I mean, this can't be the market. This must be a bubble here.
Well, I, I think that it's sensible to be concerned about the London property market, that it does seem as if it's attracting a lot of overseas buying, and that prices are rising at rates that do not normally last. Outside London, the picture is different, that prices are still not back, certainly in real terms, to the peaks that they reached in 2007-08. So I think there does seem to be some London market factor and a rest of the country market.
Well, London, let's just... I mean, it's pretty shocking. I've never seen anything like £10,000 rise in house prices in 1 month. Now, even the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has stepped in the last couple of weeks to say, hang on a minute, we are creating a housing bubble. Would you deny that? I mean, because it certainly seems like that to me, that the fact that people need housing so desperately is being used to simply jack up the price to create a kind of artificial recovery.
I don't think the rise in housing prices is creating an artificial recovery. I think that's coming from more deep-seated reasons, and that the recent figures you've been quoting have come after the GDP figures that have shown the economy beginning to recover. I think with our history of housing bubbles, it's sensible to be concerned about the housing market rising too quickly. And I think the government is right to be pushing to build more houses, because the real reason prices are rising is because there's a shortage of supply, the population has been growing, and the occupation density has been declining. That's something that's been happening for many, many decades, and therefore more houses are needed, and the numbers built in recent years, and this is true with the Conservative government, true with the Labour government, has been too low, and the government is pushing very hard to get the number up, with some quite difficult political consequences.
Also on housing, in The Independent this week, Jacob, is an article by Jonathan Owen. More than 500,000 Britons are facing eviction from the homes they own or rent, according to a new analysis of possession claims served on households by the courts during the past year. The scale of the crisis equates to more than 4,000 households being at risk of losing their home every week, Shelter has warned. While more than 215,000 possession claims have been served on people since April last year, in some parts of the country, the situation is so bad that 1 in 34 households is in danger of being repossessed, according to the charity's analysis of county court records from England between April 2013 and March this year. Newham in London, guess what? London again tops a list of hotspots revealed by Shelter, with 1 in 34 households having possession claims made against them. Now, this is very worrying, isn't it? I mean, people want to own their own homes, but they're finding that it's becoming more and more difficult due to job insecurity mainly to actually keep them.
I think it's one of the real conundrums that the Bank of England faces, that the downturn post-2008 was the most severe that we have seen since the 1930s. In that period, unemployment rose much less than anticipated, and fewer people found they were defaulting on their mortgages because of the exceptionally low interest rates. However, at the other end of the market, very low interest rates encourage speculative purchase of houses. So the Bank of England has to get this balance right to ensure that interest rates remain low enough to help people whose incomes have gone down since 2008, but at the same time not to allow such ease of capital that a housing bubble is re-inflated. And I don't think it's an easy balancing act for them.
I don't think it is an easy balancing act, Jacob. It's never been an easy balancing act in Britain, has it? As you mentioned, we've got a history of having housing bubbles in this country, and we've not really taken the necessary steps to prevent them. So in the 1960s, we used to talk about stop-go economics, where whenever the economy picked up, we had to raise interest rates to prevent inflation and house prices from rising, which then, of course, made the economy grind to a halt. So it's more go-stop than stop-go. And sadly, I don't see that this recovery that we're having at the moment is very different from any of the ones we've seen before. And certainly the problems weren't tackled when there was a Labour government. They didn't do much on the social housing side, for example. I would like to see more of a consensus around housing. I mean, the biggest builders of social housing in Britain were the Conservative governments of the 1950s. And if you have a solid commitment to social housing, council housing as it then was, you can stabilise the property market for the benefit to the benefit of everybody. But of course, we've developed what might be called a sort of poisonous political economy around this, where the possessor principle, people can actually make money by just sitting on their properties, whether at a low level or at a big level, like the Duke of Westminster. But ultimately, of course, we're undermining our exporting base. We need to make and build things rather than rely upon property prices to keep everybody happy. And I'm not blaming particularly this government. It's something that's been going on for a very long time.
Jacob, I mean, if a government can't safely and securely house its people, why should people bother to vote? I mean, we've heard only 36% voted yesterday.
Well, I'm not surprised. Only 36% people voted in a mainly European election that it hardly sets the pulse racing. I think more important is the turnout we get in general election. The government doesn't house the people. There is a private sector housing market that is the bulk of the market, and I think the issue is the total number of houses built, because the market is dynamic, and therefore the use of those houses between different deciles of income varies depending on the total supply. So that if we get back to 250,000 houses built per annum, which is probably where we ought to be, then you will find that prices stabilise, probably even come down a little. And that the real task is having a functioning planning system that gets houses built in reasonable areas and in reasonable numbers. And I think the planning system has become so bogged down, or had become so bogged down, that it made it very, very difficult to have a sensible policy.
Now, isn't that one of the reasons that there is this housing bubble, is that we've got a lot of economic migration? I mean, UKIP have done very well out of this by saying, well, you know, we've got too many immigrants coming into Britain, and, you know, they've capitalised on that. But there is one of the facts of the matter is that we just simply don't have enough housing to house everybody. That's one of the reasons why we've seen this massive increase, like I said, £10,000 in London in 1 month in house prices. So how to address that? Because there's no point in trying to sort out the housing market, surely, Jacob, if we're going to continue to have mass migration, and that will simply fill up every single house that we're building. It won't actually relieve the demand on housing.
Well, it's slightly more than that there's also been a decrease in the occupancy of houses. In broad terms, the number of people living in each household in 1900 was 4.5, and by 2000 was down to just over 2. So you see from that, you needed a more than doubling of the housing stock just to house the existing population. On top of that, from 97 to 2010, there's an inflow of around 2 million people if you netted off the people who leave, that order of magnitude. So that requires another million houses. That is not an amount that, had there been sensible building, we couldn't have achieved, but the planning system wasn't up to producing those numbers. So that is the issue we're at now. Of course, if you continue with mass migration, you will need more housing to be built, and you'll need more hospitals and more schools and more roads. That is obviously true, and indeed has resonated strongly with UKIP. It's been a powerful recruiting sergeant for them.
Now, let's have a look then at some of the results from the elections yesterday, the local elections. Now, the UKIP has gained over 130 seats, we hear, in the Independent, as support surges across the country. A jubilant Nigel Farage insisted that his party was set to cause tremors in Westminster after securing more than 130 council seats. The party shrugged off a campaign blighted by allegations of racism from party candidates, variously described as fruitcakes and loons. Senior Labour MP David Lammy insisted his comments about Romanian immigrants made it clear he's a racist, dismissing his own party leader Ed Miliband's refusal to describe him in such terms as pedantic. And I think we'll start with Martin on this, because really, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, the Labour Party could have expected to have done rather better, couldn't they, this election, just coming in next year to a general election. It looks like maybe the UK Independence Party has taken quite a lot of the votes that Labour might have expected as a backlash against the coalition government.
I think that's certainly something for the Labour Party to think about. But the fact of the matter is that Labour did make gains in the local elections, and the Conservatives and the Liberals did not, and UKIP made substantial gains. I think we're moving towards a more than two-party system. We've been more than a two-party system for a very long time. And I think this is turning the outcome of next year's general election into a bit of a lottery, because it's not a two-way fight. And UKIP's going to take votes from all the other parties, it looks like, and in such a way that the outcome is quite likely to be a minority government elected on a minority of the vote. But that's, in a way, a normal under our first-past-the-post system. Margaret Thatcher, for example, never got 50% of the vote.
So why hasn't Ed Miliband... I mean, he's made some really serious gaffes, hasn't he, in some of the campaigning. I mean, for example, in Swindon, we heard him not even knowing who controlled Swindon Council. Do you think Miliband is the right person to take the party into the next general election?
Well, I can promise you this. There is going to be no change of the pilot of the ship at this stage of the game. There's no stomach for that inside the Labour Party whatsoever. We will go into the next election with Ed Miliband as the leader, rightly or wrongly, and there's not really much point discussing it.
Jacob, you've had a bloody nose from UKIP, most definitely in the local elections. Almost certainly we'll find out on Sunday. I don't know why that is. We have to wait so long for the EU elections.
I can tell you if you want.
Yes, do. Yeah, tell us. Thanks.
It's a European law that requires voting not to start until the polls across Europe have closed, on the thought that if people in other countries knew what had happened in the early voting countries, it might influence their vote.
OK, well, I mean, what happens to the ballot boxes in the meantime? Because that was a question here in Bristol in the mayor elections. The ballot boxes for the mayoral elections were held overnight at Bristol City Sports Ground with no CCTV coverage in a private, run by private security. I mean, is that really the way we want to run our elections, with private security looking after our ballot boxes overnight for a few nights?
Well, I left the Guildhall at Bath late last night, where we had a by-election counted, and at that point the Euro votes in locked containers were being wheeled into a locked room in the Guildhall to be kept safely until Sunday. I can't see the harm in getting on and counting. I think it's highly unlikely that the UK result would make French voters change their mind.
I mean, I've seen footage in the US where ballot boxes kept overnight have actually, shown video of people going in and interfering with the vote. I mean, God forbid that should happen here. But it certainly seems like that's only possible if you have these delays between the vote and the count, and I don't think most candidates would want to see that. But anyway, back to the substantive point, which is about the UK Independence Party. Don't you think you've really lost... a lot of seats here, Jacob, because the Conservative Party has a serious problem with Europe, and it has done for probably the last 20, 30 years, that you can't make your mind up whether you want to be in or out?
I think there are separate things. I think, yes, indeed, there are various views in the Conservative Party on Europe, and then there's the election yesterday. The election yesterday, the Conservatives did very respectably for a party in midterm, still a year away from an election, from a period 4 years ago when we were on the cusp of winning an election. So we're down currently by 189 seats. That's respectable, but normally you would expect to do worse at this stage in the electoral cycle. Labour is up by 267 seats. I'm reading this off the BBC screen, so it's latest figures. Labour's up by 267, but was forecast to expect 400 to 500 gains. So they've done disappointingly. Interestingly, the Lib Dems down by 258. Some people thought they'd be down by a lot more than that. And their vote hasn't been going to Labour, which is a surprise, because that was what it looked as if was happening in opinion polls until really the beginning of this year, when it looked as if the Lib Dem vote had roughly halved with that 10% going to Labour. And they haven't managed to convert that on an election day. And that's quite encouraging for Conservatives, because to some extent we need the Lib Dem vote to hold up in a general election. The rise of UKIP is to some extent a plague on all your houses. It's very interesting to see them picking up seats in pretty safe Labour council areas. And it's interesting that they did so in spite of a not very successful campaign. I think their campaign was beset by problems, from some of the views expressed by a number of their candidates. So if they can do this well with a poor campaign, how well would they have done with a good campaign?
Well, the Greens have done reasonably well with an extra 15 seats across the country. UKIP, an extra 147 seats. And Labour really have done best, Martin, with an extra 267 seats across the country. But, you know, like I say, you could expect that, couldn't you? It's going to be a general election next year, and we're right in the middle of Tory... I should say coalition, shouldn't I? So what are your thoughts about Labour's performance again, Martin?
Well, we could have done better, there's no doubt about that. There'll be no doubt internal discussions about what went wrong in terms of not doing as well as we would have hoped. I think the real issue here, as I said earlier, is we're moving to a more than two-party system. And the first-past-the-post system, which I oppose, and I don't know what Jacob's
Look,
views on
rather that. Than talking about the electoral system, I mean, surely what the Labour Party should have done is to come up with a credible alternative economic plan. And there's been none of that.
No, well, the problem is that we're all stuck in a situation where we are essentially... When quantitative easing began 5 years ago, it was supposed to go on for 5 months. It was supposed to be an emergency measure to stabilise the situation, bring liquidity to the banks, and then we would go back to normal. Now, in actual fact, all over the world, not just in Britain, we have got a situation where we've had zero interest rate policies for years on end, which does have perverse effects, as Jacob pointed out earlier, because it makes the cost of money has actually become one of the most fundamental prices in the economy is being manipulated downwards. And what recovery we are seeing is based on this very, very shaky foundation. So we saw last year when the Federal Reserve started to rein back on its quantitative easing programme, immediately crises broke out in the emerging markets, which nearly came back to haunt the developed countries as well. And I'm afraid that we've all got used to the idea that free money can be printed indefinitely. And I'm afraid the real free marketeers in the von Mises Institute and elsewhere know very well, and I tend to agree with them, that ultimately this will crash. And it's not because people want it to, it's just because it will.
OK, so what is your, not Labour's, but your alternative economic plan?
I think we should have nationalised the banks properly in 2008 and taken them into public ownership.
We can't talk about redoing history. We're talking about what to do now.
Well, what we'll have to... Well, nothing will happen now because everybody's living on the free money wave that's been created, and nobody in the mainstream is willing to challenge that because it's basically saying that we don't really know what to do.
So you're saying that you've got no idea?
No, what will happen is there will be another crash, and at that point we will have to move towards...
So what would you do to stop that happening?
Well, we will have to set up a publicly run banking system, which will probably be run like a utility in the end. I mean, you've got a model for this in the Bank of North Dakota in the US, which is owned by the state of North Dakota, set up by populist politicians in the 1900s. And it basically leads to the state being solvent because it's got its own bank. And of course, once you've got a properly run public banking system like that, there's little point having private banking. And ultimately, that's where we're going to go, but we'll have to go through a crash first.
The quantitative easing, Jacob, that's helping people at the top quarter of society. It's helping people with share investments and that kind of thing, with investments in property, assets, various assets. But those with nothing, or less than nothing, it's not really helping them at all. Do you think it's worked? It's been successful? And do you think it should carry on, this whole printing money, quantitative easing business?
I think quantitative easing has so far been successful, and it hasn't just helped people at the top. It's helped businesses remain in operation. It's kept them solvent, and that has meant people have remained employed. And so millions of people have kept jobs because of quantitative easing, and tens of thousands have been able to remain in their homes because their mortgages have been lowered. And I think that's important, that... Sometimes economic theory and political reality clash, and there might have been a very brutal system that you could have had without quantitative easing that would have made people's lives much more difficult, but might have been more economically pure. I, however, agree that this needs to be withdrawn at some point, that you cannot continue creating money from nowhere without it becoming inflation.
But surely we're hooked on it now. We're like heroin addicts, hooked on it.
I wonder whether that's right. There was quite an interesting figure in the Financial Times, I think in December of last year, that said over the course of the year, a third of the so-called zombie companies, that is to say companies that were able to pay their interest but no more, had gone from being zombie companies to being profitable again. And that as that begins to happen, there will be an opportunity to increase interest rates slowly without causing a catastrophe. And the US Federal Reserve is already reducing its monetary operations and the amount of money it puts into the market every month. And the markets are coping with that, and the economy is coping with that. The Bank of England has a large stock of government debt, and selling it may be a problem. But if the Bank of England is not buying more government debt and it's sold in the normal way to the market, that also begins to lessen the problem. So I think we may get away without another crash. It's a mixture of gradual policy changes and prudent government financing.
But looking at the actual graph, I mean, all this is about graphics. It's the only way that you can really visualise it, Jacob. Is if you look at the national debt, it's still going up at an even greater rate than it was back in 2008. We're going up and up and up. There's no even hint that the economic policies since the 2010 election are putting a dent in that at all. We're becoming more and more indebted all the time.
Well, we're not going up at an even greater rate. We were going up at over £150 billion. A year, and it's now around £100 billion a year. So there's been a significant reduction in the absolute level. But more importantly, there's been a reduction in the relative level that in 2008 you had a public sector deficit of, I think, about 11.5% of GDP, but of a GDP that had shrunk. Now we've got a public sector deficit that is significantly lower, but also of a GDP that is growing, so that you get a narrowing in both directions. I think if that trend can continue, then you get back to a budget balance in due course. But yes, it's slow, it's long, but the level of the decline was, as I said earlier, the worst since the 1930s. It would be unreasonable to have expected a very rapid recovery.
Well, I think pretty much that's what Ed Balls was saying all along, is that you're not going to reduce this deficit in one go. And I think that although George Osborne hasn't shouted it from the rooftops, that's effectively what he's decided to do, is to go steady on it, which of course is rational. If you try and reduce the deficit too quickly, you crash the economy and then in fact increase it in every possible way. But I still have my doubts about whether you can finesse this policy in such a way as to avoid a crash. I mean, look at the history of it, and this is the biggest money printing spree in history. The bubble is bigger than any in history, and I don't see anything in economic theory that suggests that this will lead to a soft landing. You might get a soft landing in China because they've got a very regulated banking system, but I think the very deregulated banking system that we've developed in the West is just prone to crashes, and it seems more likely than anything else that that's what's going to happen to me.
So what are we, Jacob? We're around about 1.3 trillion now, are we? And heading upwards at 100,000... What is it? 100,000 million.
About 100 billion a year.
100 billion a year. Don't you think it's time for a Plan B? This is, I mean, all of it seems to me to be just tinkering. Actually, what's happening is we are becoming more and more indebted. More and more of what we're doing right across this land is just simply paying off interest to the banks. These banks, by the way, have been doing money laundering, LIBOR fixing. There's another thing, Eurobor fixing as well this week, and none of them are actually being properly prosecuted or shut down as they should be.
Well, I think one thing's worth saying that's important, that this is not completely unprecedented. The move off the gold standard in the 1930s is equivalent to the money printing that's being done now. It was basically a doubling of the effective money supply by halving the value of the dollar to gold. I mean, it was really extraordinary devaluation and injection of liquidity into the US economy. And the UK went along similar lines. So It's not quite as unprecedented as it seems, and a severe crash needs a serious answer, an answer that you wouldn't use in normal times. In terms of the debt levels, private sector debt levels have now been falling, and that's quite encouraging. The government debt levels have taken up some of the slack, and And they had to. That the economy had turned down so sharply that tax revenues declined, and the government had commitments to spend money. It couldn't suddenly stop spending overnight, and therefore it would have made the economy far worse if the government had not allowed the automatic stabilisers to work. That is to say, the increase in benefits that are being paid to people whose incomes had declined, but also recognising the decline in taxation to fund government programmes. So I think taking things reasonably steadily, but at the same time putting downward pressure on government expenditure, has been a pretty good balance.
Well, I mean, the trouble is that you haven't really made much of a dent in this increasing debt. But don't you think it's time for a plan B, like I say? Because people are getting fed up with spending most of their lives. In fact, much of our activity is just to do with, certainly from the government's point of view anyway, is just paying off this debt. And actually, it's still climbing and climbing. I mean, if this was your household accounts, I think you'd probably be having a heart attack.
I can see absolutely no reason for plan B now, that plan A is actually working, that the government deficit is coming down, tax revenues are now rising quite sharply, GDP is growing at its most rapid rate in many years. There are some really positive signs in the economy because broadly the right decisions were made, which were a very loose monetary policy and a pretty tight fiscal policy, and those two provided the right balance against an over-indebted economy.
I think the real problem is Mark Carney's decision about interest rates. In order to prevent a housing bubble, he may have to raise interest rates, and I don't think that the economy can stand that, even though, of course, as an independent central bank governor, he may decide that he's got to take the punch bowl away from the party. I think the problem with any raising of interest rates is the old story about you're trying to move a brick with a piece of elastic, and you pull on it and nothing happens, and then suddenly it hits you in the eye. I'm afraid that the kind of financial markets we have now aren't really suitable for that kind of fine-tuning. The fiscal stabilisers, for example, have been undermined over the years by the reductions in tax rates at the top and the cutting of benefits at the bottom. So, in other words, all of the attack upon welfare benefits has been counterproductive in many ways in relation to fiscal stabilisation. And I still see a crash as pretty much inevitable. I wouldn't say totally inevitable, but pretty much so. And of course, when that happens, the political classes from all the major parties are going to look very silly, and people a lot worse than UKIP are going to come marching out of the shadows.
Of course, the result of all of this, Jacob, is that there's been a massive reining back on unemployment benefits and things like that, enormous amounts of sanctions, nearly a million in one year, many of which are not justified, people being sort of tricked into doing things that mean that they're left with no money for any food. And there is still an enormous problem with unemployment. Now, there's one story this week which just paints a picture for one person. It's a tragic youngster killed himself because he couldn't get a job. He was too proud to claim benefits. This is in the Mirror. Martin Hadfield, 20, was driven to despair after being rejected for 40 jobs, which had left him feeling worthless, an inquest heard. Eventually, he was left so demoralised he took his own life. Despite being unemployed for months, proud Martin refused to accept state handouts. In the space of just 12 weeks, he'd tried for 40 jobs. Most of his applications failed to generate even a courteous response. Now, this is just one story, Jacob, but there's a picture right across the country we've got of coming on for a million young people, desperately looking for work and having really no interest from the jobs market. And it's not good enough to say, I'm sorry, they've just got to try harder, because they are already trying hard. There's just one person here who's lost their life now as a result.
Well, that's tragic when people commit suicide. All suicides are a tragic loss of life. Youth unemployment has been falling. The ability of the government to create jobs is through making the right economic decisions that allow businesses to create employment. Governments do not create jobs directly, that they have to do it through allowing businesses to create jobs. And I think this government has done that, which is why we actually have record levels of employment in this country, and they've gone up significantly over the last 4 years.
Yes, yes, but there are, many of these are zero-hour contracts. Many of the people that have got those jobs desperately want more work. They want to at least have a full-time job. What's happened is, over the last 20 years, there's been an eroding of job security.
In the early stage of the recovery, a lot of the jobs were indeed part-time, but in the more recent figures, we've seen a lot of jobs are full-time. I think it's part of the natural stage of recovery that you see in the early stages employers tentatively going back to the market and offering part-time jobs, and as things pick up further they offer full-time jobs, and that's been happening, and employment, as I say, is at record levels, so that's very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, the economy is now nearly at the same size that it was in 2008, which in modern history is quite extraordinary, really. I mean, you'd expect a modern capitalist economy to be growing regularly, year on year. So we've had 5 years where we had a dip, and then the economy went flatlined, and now it's started to grow again. But as you say, we've got more people officially employed than ever, which means that productivity per worker must have fallen, which it has, which implies that all of the jobs that have been created must, logically, be low-wage, low-productivity jobs. And the potential here is that we're creating a low-wage economy, unlike, for example, countries like Finland and Norway, which have actually increased wages in industrial employment. I see this recovery as very much built on sand, and I fear that even if it was successful, we're creating a 19th century style economy with a lot of very low paid service work, and we're not actually getting into the high tech sectors that we ought to be in.
I'm not sure that's the right conclusion to draw on productivity. I think part of the reason that productivity has declined is that people have remained in employment through a very sharp downturn in the economy, because we have a flexible labour market. And that's actually very positive, because it means as the economy picks up, productivity can increase, and that will help people's take-home pay increase as well. I think a flexible labour market has actually helped maintain high levels of employment. And the downturn from 2008 was exceptionally sharp, that the excesses built up prior to that were unprecedented. We reached a private sector debt to GDP level of 450%. The worst we'd managed before was in the run-up to the 1930s crash of 250%. So in terms of scale, the excesses up until 2008 were quite extraordinary. And it's not surprising that if you have an excessive boom, you will have a more serious downturn. And the statistics that the Office for National Statistics have provided have kept on revising down the decline, and therefore the bounce back has been stronger, but from a lower level.
Okay, Jacob. Yes, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you can hear there. He's a Conservative MP for North East Somerset. One of the results of all of this, Jacob, is a lot of cuts to policing. Now, the Police Federation this week got its public funding withdrawn. Is this Theresa May's revenge for Plebgate? The New Statesman says it's never easy for a government minister to challenge the police. Crassly condemning it, the police can seem like coddling criminals, the opposite from the tough stance most recent Home Secretaries have wanted to project. So it's particularly noteworthy that Home Secretary Theresa May, a minister with more right-wing credentials than many of her cabinet colleagues today, that is earlier this week, launched a broadside against the Police Federation. She told its conference in Bournemouth, "I can announce today that this public funding will be stopped altogether from August." Now, what are your thoughts about that? It does seem like a really attempt to bamboozle and bully the Police Federation, Jacob.
Not really. The Police Federation has built up a large surplus, and it's perfectly reasonable for it to pay for its own officers. I can't think why the state should fund effectively a trade union. That's a matter for its members to fund.
Well, I mean, the reason that they do that is because they don't want it to be an independent trade union, and it helps. I mean, the Police Federation isn't quite as democratic and as autonomous as ordinary trade unions, and the procedures aren't quite so easy to change, for example. Anyway, what are your thoughts about the cutbacks to the police? Because the police are starting to fight back, and now they're being told by the Home Secretary, well, if you want to fight back, we're not going to help you do it. We're not going to be paying for the Police Federation anymore. This sounds to me like a recipe to even further demoralise our police.
I don't think that's right. The Police Federation has its own money to fund its own officers. It doesn't need further state subsidy. It gets subscriptions from police officers who pay to employ Federation officials. So I don't think it needs an extra amount from the Home Office on top. And I generally believe that independent organisations should be self-funding rather than expect endless government subsidies. In terms of the reduction in the number of police, there has been a cut to their funding. But crime has also been falling. Crime has been falling now since the mid-1990s, and you would have thought that if crime is falling, you don't need as many police.
Martin?
Well, I think, having relatives who've been police officers, if crime is falling, you should the police are doing their job properly. But you shouldn't presume that by reducing their funding, that the job will continue to be done properly. I mean, the policing system in Britain is fairly labour-intensive. We do, in fact, ask a lot of our police officers in terms of getting involved in the community and trying to prevent crime, which is all good. I mean, that's what should be happening. And I think one of the problems with the last Labour government was this target-driven culture where the police see their job as solving crimes rather than preventing crimes. So if as a society, crime is getting less, that would be good. But there has to be a suspicion that, of course, that certain crimes are not being reported, because then they'll have to be solved. And I've certainly had personal experience of dealing with police officers where we've come to a conclusion between us that it's better not to report what's happening, and we'll deal with it in another way so that we're not creating problems for the officers concerned.
Jacob, don't you think you could be stoking up trouble here by withdrawing money from the Police Federation? It just means that the police are more likely to take various forms of industrial action, maybe go on their marches, this kind of thing, and to actually start getting organised against the present government.
I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I think the Police Federation has great problems, that its organisational structures, the people who've been leading it, have not led it in a particularly creditable way. And that does not reflect on police officers. I think we're extraordinarily lucky in this country to have the high-quality police we have. I mean, I think it's particularly true in Somerset and Avon, where obviously I'm a local Member of Parliament, where we have a really first-class police force of dedicated officers who are part of the community, who are involved with their community, and who have been very effective at reducing crime. The Avon Somerset Constabulary has an exceptionally good track record.
Well, why is the government then bringing in people like the bosses of Tesco and sheriffs from Los Angeles to take over these senior police jobs if the police that we've got are doing such a good job?
You can always improve. There's no harm.
Is that going to be an improvement, Jacob, to bring a sheriff over from Los Angeles?
Well, I don't think they have yet. I mean, I think that's one of those things that's been talked
They're advertising
about.
Here right now for those jobs.
They've been talking about bringing in new people. But actually, a number of senior people in the police service are in favour of bringing in some outsiders. There's been a general trend in the police and the civil service in various areas of life to allow more flexibility in employment. And the idea of jobs for life in so many areas, so many professions, has changed with people having a more variety in what they do. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
But why is running the Avon and Somerset Police like, say, running a canning factory, which someone from industry might have done?
Well, I don't think anybody suggested that the Chief Constable should be replaced by somebody who's running a canning factory. I don't know where you've got that from.
Well, this is what they're doing with the direct entry, is bringing people from industry, completely unspecified which industries, into the senior superintendent and higher level jobs.
Well, people will have to be qualified in a certain field to be able to do that job effectively. There are many skills that are needed in running complex organisations, which the police service is. And I think there are very few jobs that have a monopoly position for a particular career structure. I think being open to new ideas, new entrants is likely to be a good thing. But people obviously have to be capable of doing it. They have to pass an interview to do it. They have to be considered to be suitable, and I think that will find on some occasions exceptionally talented people from outside who are capable of leading police services, but they will have to quickly gain police qualifications.
Okay, one story we can't miss this week. Vladimir Putin is behaving just like Hitler, says Prince Charles. His controversial verdict on the Russian leader's invasion of, well, it says Ukraine here, but actually he didn't invade Ukraine, as far as I know. It was just Crimea.
Oh, hold on. Crimea was legally a part of Ukraine until Mr. Putin invaded it and took it away. And that's like saying that the Isle of Wight isn't part of the United Kingdom.
Ah, so do the Russians have rights to have their troops on the Isle of Wight?
I hope not, but they had a port on in the Crimea, but it absolutely was a part of Ukraine. It was made a part of Ukraine by Khrushchev.
Yeah, by Khrushchev in 1954. Look, let's cut to the chase here, because isn't this really about Syria? The Russians based their Black Sea Fleet in Crimea. That was used last summer to block an attack, probably by the US. We're not quite sure who fired these missiles at Damascus from the Eastern Mediterranean, but the Russian ships stopped that attack, and that was based at the Black Sea Fleet. Isn't the attempt to get the new Kiev government after the coup to take over Crimea just a blatant attempt to kick the Russians out of the Black Sea, Jacob?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think anyone was proposing that the Russians should use their should lose their base in the Crimea. But it is not part of the civilized world order for major powerful countries to invade their neighbours when they are a bit grumpy. And I think that Mr. Putin has behaved outside the norms of the international order.
So is the EU, the West, the US not involved at all in the coup in Kiev?
I don't think the EU's behaviour covered itself in glory either. I think it was particularly foolish to aggravate Mr. Putin. But that does not excuse or allow the invasion of an independent sovereign state.
What about Prince Charles, then? Do you think it's right for him to be making statements like this out when he's out and about in public?
Well, I think the Prince of Wales was having a private conversation and...
What, in front of the press?
Well, no, somebody eavesdropped on his conversation and reported this.
Well, he's on a public walkabout.
No, he was talking to somebody, I thought, at a reception in Canada. He was talking to a lady who was had been a survivor or the child of a survivor from the Holocaust.
But is this the sort of thing that Prince Charles should be being chatting about when he's on a public tour?
Prince Wales, the Queen obviously is also the Queen of Canada, so it's much the same as if he were on a tour in the United Kingdom. He will be King of Canada in due course. I think he's completely entitled to say these things in private circumstances.
I mean, is he also entitled to write his little letters to the ministers, which we're never allowed to see?
Definitely. That he's going to be the King of England. He is going to have an important constitutional role to be in discussions with ministers, not to tell them what to do, but to encourage or warn and to be consulted. That's the constitutional role of the monarch. And as we have a constitutional monarchy, it is entirely suitable that the heir to the throne is involved in this, so that when he becomes king, he is ready to do it.
Do you agree with his analysis of Vladimir Putin?
Do I agree with his analysis of Vladimir Putin?
It's going to have to be yes or no, I'm afraid.
I think you've got to be very careful about what you say about potential allies.
Definitely agree with you there. Okay, North East Somerset MP, Conservative Jacob Rees-Mogg, thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you.